This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A best-selling author plans to tell Illinois Wesleyan University students in this so-called post-truth era, be skeptical of everything you hear.
Don't be overly confident in your pet ideas and your cherished beliefs, because there's a good chance you're wrong.
Michael Shermer, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, will deliver Illinois Wesleyan University's president's convocation next week. Plus, Illinois Wesleyan University today is starting to take delivery of several dozen Steinway pianos as it becomes an all-Steinway school. We'll tell you what that means. Mary Cullen reports on the rise of women in Illinois State University student governance. For the first time, an all-female executive board. And the mayor of Bloomington drops by. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The Bloomington City Council has ended its moratorium on new video gambling licenses and also finally sold some land on the west side to the Boys and Girls Club. Mayor Terry Renner is in studio with WGLT's Ryan Denham to discuss these developments and more.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most Tuesdays after their regular and special council meetings. Mayor Renner, thanks again for your time on Sound Ideas.
Thank you, Ryan. It's great to be here as always.
Let's start with video gambling. The council voted 8-1 to allow for 8 additional licenses in addition to the 52 that the city has already granted. This comes after a long moratorium where new licenses were put on hold, intended to curtail any kind of explosion in gambling in the city. So what do you think of the council's decision here, kind of reopening the door for more video gambling?
Well, I think there's several conflicting thoughts. First of all, I'm not a gambler, and I don't like it. I don't even really like the machines. But that's really not my position as mayor. As mayor, it is part of what the state of Illinois, frankly, has opened up this can of worms, and it is part of economic development. So I definitely have experienced in terms of conversations with people who have not been able to sell their businesses because of the moratorium, because the profit margin goes from being in the red to being in the black. If you've got video poker machines in many establishments, it's part of what, unfortunately, we're dealt with. So I have to deal with the cards that are dealt with me. And this is one of those times where I would agree that with those that say that the market ought to come up with whatever that limit is. Because I don't know that 60 establishments the limit is 62. How do you even come up with that number? And I think at some point we would hit saturation. And so I think the market would correct itself. And especially these days, it's so place specific, the focus of this debate. Whereas you and I can pick up our phone and start gambling, at any point, in any place, sitting in our living room. And that's, I don't mean that as a good thing. I mean that's just as an empirical observation. So I was conflicted about this, but my position was that I didn't think we should get into the regulatory business of this, with the exception that we don't want video poker parlors in Bloomington, and we have been very aggressive on the Liquor Commission in making sure that that's not the case. But to ultimately get to your question, I think this was a compromise, and this is a compromise that I think we can all live with. Again, or almost all, it was an 8-1 vote. As I did promise, I would not either veto what the council passed or the mayor of Bloomington has a line item or an item veto, so I could take specific parts of it. The problem with it is the city manager did a great job of helping to put together a compromise. And if I were to like pick it apart, then the whole might not equal the sum of the parts. So I already signed it. I signed it this morning, reluctantly signed it. But It is a compromise. There's plenty in there for everybody to like and dislike.
And you mentioned it being very site-specific. So to that end, there was also sort of a side vote last night about big truck stops and how many video gambling machines they can have in Bloomington. Council voted to hold that number at 5. not raising it, or not 10. What did you think of that discussion about what truck stops should have in the special place?
I thought the discussion was a very good and healthy discussion. I think the council laid out the pros and cons of that. I would have, you know, it went down 5-4. I would have supported the upper limit just because that's what the state of Illinois did, and I think we would be at a competitive disadvantage to other truck stops and other places in immediate communities if we have 5 versus 10. And this is also a situation where, frankly, most of the people that are going to be at those truck stops, if not almost everyone, are going to be people who are in transit. And you know, in a kind of a cold, cruel, crass way, as mayor, I want them to drop as much money here while they're in Bloomington as, you know, as possible, as opposed to other communities. You know, that just is one of the realities. It's an unfortunate reality. I wish if this wasn't dealing with gambling, I think it'd be a whole different story.
So you've got 8 more licenses in the mix here, taking it up to 60. Presuming that brings in extra revenue for the city. Does the city have any obligation, do you think, to pump money into sort of the addiction side of this and funding treatment? What is that role?
And I think that's, you know, that's a part of a broader conversation. But I do think that absolutely we have an obligation to do that. Now, and I think it's more than just putting a sticker as part of this ordinance that says, hey, you can call this. That's kind of like on your cigarette package where you see the little note that cigarette smoking, you know, is hazardous to your health. I don't know what that might look like. Some of that could be direct or indirect funding. Some of it certainly could be funding through the Scott Health Commission, through the township. There may be any number of possibilities. But it's also not just gambling addictions. It's addictions generally that I think that we, you know, need to step up to the plate on. And we did with mental health. I don't mean to say that we haven't, with the quarter cent sales tax increase 4 years ago that is earmarked for mental health in McLean County.
So do you think this is it for video gambling for a while? You think the city can kind of ride out this current approach to video gambling for the foreseeable future? Are there any additional sort of policy questions that are still floating out there on this?
Yeah, I think we're going to hit the 60 within maybe the first day that this opens up on September 15th. So I think we're going to hit the upper limit. And so at that point, I'm not quite sure what happens. I don't think the council is going to be willing to revisit this decision anytime soon. Does that mean that people will be content? No. There will definitely, we'll be hearing it at the Liquor Commission in public comment or in other issues. But certainly putting that ceiling on is going to have fairly immediate effects, because as I say, I could be wrong, but I doubt it. I'm betting that first day that we're going to hit the ceiling of 60, or at least get that number of applications, if not more.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, a week ago, the council met for its less formal Committee of the Whole meeting. One of the things that you guys talked about was how to get ready for marijuana legalization. Council member Jen Carrillo at that time was pushing for a cannabis task force, bringing together stakeholders like residents, the police, other kind of stakeholders. What did you think of that idea, that kind of shape for a body to explore these municipal issues?
Well, I thought Alderwoman Carrillo's idea was a very good one. That work has to be done regardless of whether it's done by a commission or whether it's done by staff and the city council. And in the past, I have appointed commissions when we had a budget task force in 2015, then a downtown task force in 2016. There were 9 members. In both cases, I put 3 council members on, which would be the maximum, you know, in order to not avoid problems with Open Meetings Act. And I thought actually both of those went, I mean, there were some, they weren't perfect, but I thought, for example, that the task force report by the Downtown Commission was really first rate and was solid, evidence-based, fact-based. Even if people didn't agree with everything that was in there, I thought it was really well done. And the budget task force did uncover all kinds of things that we could explore. Now, it turned out that a lot of those were not things we could do, like privatizing golf courses. Turns out it would cost us more money to privatize the golf courses than to keep it in-house as we currently do. But it did illuminate lots of possibilities, and we did pursue all of those possibilities. It also made it quite clear that there was no pot of gold in solving our budget problem, that we had already gone from about 850 full-time equivalent employees 9 years ago to about 650 today. Employees aren't the only thing, but we've already got a lean force, that is a workforce. And so that's one of the things that it pointed out. So I would, obviously, I have no hesitation about going down the task force route. And I think it would be a good idea to have, and I would, you know, I would think we'd do nine, have six aldermen or women, you know, on that. Doesn't have to be. Obviously, the council has, you know, would make that decision. I could appoint a mayoral task force, but I'd want it, you know, under the circumstances, I'd want the council to have buy-in on that. I wouldn't just do it like I did with those other two, essentially unilaterally.
So what is your sense of where the council is on this? Is that, you think that's something they want to?
I don't know about the task force. Some people expressed some skepticism about the task force as a procedure. But at the end of the day, these are questions we have to wrestle with, because I don't think there's any question that we're not going to be an opt-out city. There may be some people on the council that would like us to opt out, but I don't think it's going to be a majority. And as I have said publicly before, I think that would be a mistake, so I would veto it. You would need a supermajority on the council to override my veto of that. I think we've got to accept the reality that this is there. And, frankly, it's a revenue source. And so for all of those reasons, I don't think we're going to be an opt-out city. I don't think that Normal will either. And so I think we've got to, you know, move forward. And I think we also really need to, you know, one of the tasks, either of a task force or whoever is charged with moving forward on this, is to work with the town of Normal to be sure that as much as possible, we've got the same language and we have the same requirements in both communities.
Yeah. Do you see that cooperation even being more than just checking to see that you're on the same page? Do you think that the, I don't know, it could be like a joint task force or some kind of joint body that comes together?
I think everything's on the table and something like that. Absolutely. And so as we move forward, one of the things that we, that probably one of the biggest issues of law enforcement is going to be, how do you determine what kinds of equipment do we get to determine intoxication, the equivalent of intoxication for people who are high, on cannabis? And it's that we're not blazing a new trail here. It's other states have dealt with this. State of California has dealt with this. But you can't use alcohol breathalyzers to determine that.
Yeah. What are some of the other kind of thorniest issues at the local level? Because, I mean, the state just went through a pretty long debate. There was a lot of stakeholders at the table. I mean, it seems like every day there was a story in the news about the marijuana debate, and then it passed, right? So at the local level, I mean, what are these kind of outstanding issues?
I think one would be, of course, do you opt in or you opt out? The other is, how do you, what does law enforcement do? I think that's another critical issue. And there can only be one in our metro area, and that is the metropolitan statistical area as defined by the Census Bureau here is McLean County and DeWitt.
So one dispensary.
One. And
Normal already has one, right? They have
yes.
one in North Normal?
Correct.
So we're going to have two.
Those that currently have dispensaries can have open up a second one. So my guess is, in fact, I'd be shocked if pretty much all of them throughout the state didn't open a second one, because they're quite profitable, quite lucrative. So at the end of the day, you're absolutely right. There really is very little wiggle room on the part of the locality. Unless they can opt out, they can opt in. They opt in, they have law enforcement issues and other kinds of things that they want to make sure that there are protections and other things. You wouldn't want to have people smoking cannabis probably in public buildings and or within a certain number of feet, kind of like cigarette smoking, right? So there are some issues like that. I don't think this is brain surgery. I think that a commission like this could do its work in maybe four or five meetings.
So how much interest has the city received from businesses and potential business owners looking to open? A lot.
Yes.
Could you quantify that in any meaningful way?
Dozens. In terms of conversations, not necessarily people who said, hey, here's my business plan, come forward. But in terms of conversations of people who would have the means to move forward. But at the end of the day, the state of Illinois will decide, not us, who gets that one contract.
Do you think that Bloomington could position itself as sort of a not a destination, but sort of a tourism place where people can come and get this product? I think because there are so many communities that are opting out, and we're seeing that in our neck of the woods. I think it was Morton that opted out. All over the state, we're seeing that more and more communities saying, "Yeah, no thanks." Bloomington and Normal may be unique in the respect that they're going to say, probably, yeah, sure. Let's have one or two.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, again, this is being purely Machiavellian as a mayor to say, please, other communities, opt out so that they have to come to Bloomington.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. Mayor Renner, let's pivot to one last thing before we cut you loose. Last night, the city council unanimously approved a 3.5% pay raise for city manager Tim Gleason. It bumps his salary up to $191,000 a year. The new contract also gives him an extra week of vacation. What'd you think of this this financial pat in the back?
Well, I think it's one that says to Tim Gleason that we do value you as an employee. We think you've done an outstanding job, you know, over the last year. I think that we thought we were hiring somebody who was very good, and I think it's pretty safe to say that probably the entire council would agree we got someone who's even better than we thought. And so he has done an outstanding job. The sometimes we've heard, hey, you know, that's a lot of money to pay a city manager. Actually, for the size community we are and the size budget we have, it's below average, and it's about the amount that normal pays. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, Pam Reese does an outstanding job. But let's also face it, Bloomington is a much bigger community, nearly 80,000 as opposed to about 55,000. And we have a $220 million budget, about double that of normals. And same thing with the workforce. So the scope of the responsibilities is different. So I actually believe that, relatively speaking, the city manager, other things being equal, of Bloomington should earn considerably more, and it doesn't have to be 50% or 30%, but some increment more than the city manager, you know, in normal. This is a market, and it's a very limited market. Some people who've drawn analogies to the governor of Illinois, that this is more than the governor of Illinois earns. That's not a market, right? People, it's a different type of one. That is, people will spend hundreds of millions of dollars to get elected as governor of Illinois. When we're trying to hire a city manager, we have a comparatively limited talent pool. There aren't that many people who can manage 650 employees and a $220 million budget in the public arena. And so under those circumstances, we have to understand that the market forces operate, and as does, you know, the town of Normal understand that. So a very long answer. You know, I think that what we should do is give an extra increment as to Mr. Gleason, so that there is some gap over time between how much we pay the city manager in Bloomington as opposed to Normal.
And last night you called him a uniting force for the city council.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that? Can you give me an example of I don't know, an issue in which
all
the council
kinds
together?
Of things. He's brought the council and myself as well together on lots of different questions, and even some really tough votes that were 5-4 votes, like the 4-cent gallon, you know, per gallon gas tax. Now, whether you like it or you don't like it, the city manager wasn't out necessarily promoting it. The city manager was saying, okay, where is the council majority? And when it was clear that it was 5 and there were 4 against, he did what a good city manager did and make sure that, you know, that came forward. And the same thing with the establishment of fees for video poker machines, which we had none. We were the only metro area in Illinois not to have one. And that also wound up being a 5-4 vote. So there were some tough votes, but he understood where the council majority is. Can we come up with more than a majority? And whether or not we're talking about economic development issues, a broad range of things, Mr. Gleason has really shown some great leadership in trying to bring people together. Like, I hear you. I'm not just listening. I hear you. Can you live with this? Can you live with that? As he did with the video poker regulatory scheme that was passed last night. And by scheme, I don't mean that to be pejorative in any way, but the system that was that the council passed that I signed about an hour ago.
So how has it changed? How has Gleason's arrival changed your job as mayor? I recall you saying workload was an issue a while ago. I think you at some point you're looking to get a mayoral aide even to help with that. Do you find yourself doing less because you have Gleason at the helm?
Whether it's less, it's an easier job. And there are so many times where Tim has said to me, oh, don't worry, Mayor, it's taken care of. I never heard that in my first 5 years as mayor. I never heard that. And now I hear it all the time. So probably if I were to quantify it, I haven't done that. It's probably taken at least a few hours, you know, a week away from what I would be normally doing. And certainly some, from some tasks and things that I would prefer not to do, or I don't even have to do. But yes, Tim Gleason has made my job as mayor much easier, regardless of the number of hours. And he's also a straight shooter and a great guy to work for, or great work with, I should say.
That's Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner. Thanks again for your time this week on Sound Ideas.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
I'm Ryan Denham.
The mayors of Bloomington Normal join us most weeks after their regular and special council meetings. Next week, we'll hear from Normal Mayor Chris Koos.
Support for WJLT comes from Westminster Village, a locally owned and operated not-for-profit celebrating life and celebrating 40 years in business with a mission of providing excellence in senior living through a continuum of care and services. Details at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 WJLT and WJLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, we'll hear from the convocation speaker at Illinois Wesleyan University about the nature of truth. What it is, and how to tease it out from the information overload in our society. Gender equity in government leadership is mostly a challenge for women, but not apparently at Illinois State University. The student body has its first ever all-female leadership team. WGLT's Mary Cullen reports they may be behind a spike in women students applying for other student government positions.
Illinois State University consistently reports more female students than male. Last spring, 57% of the student body identified as female. This fall, the university installed its first all-female student executive board. Jada Turner is vice president of ISU's Student Government Association. She says female representation is long overdue. Turner says she hopes she and her female colleagues deliver a message to Redbird women.
A lot of times, women don't always go for those high power positions, especially in the business field. They get in one position and they stay there, and they don't always feel like they're capable of taking on those big, high-power roles that are predominantly men.
Turner says this year's executive board wants to change that line of thinking. Hannah Woody is this year's student body chief of staff. She says the women received a lot of support leading up to the election last spring, primarily from female peers. Woody says the women were mostly excited to see an all-female ticket pursuing a traditionally male office. Woody says having three women at the helm of the student body allows the university to consider national female-focused issues.
In the news and the media lately, there's been a lot on the topic of women's rights as it pertains to health care, equality in the workforce, etc. And I think that's something, a perspective that we can bring to campus.
And Woody says advancing women's issues to men requires media literacy.
Especially in the political climate of the United States, new perspectives are always a driving force. So I want to take this campus in a direction that it hasn't gone before.
Vice President Jada Turner and Student Body President Samiat Salibo share that passion to broaden the perspective of the student body. Salibo says she and the other executive board members didn't know they would be the first all-female ticket when they decided to run. She says she hopes to diversify the rest of the student government team and take a step away from appointing white male students.
It stops a lot of women from trying to do those roles because they think that they may either not maybe get treated the best or be heard as much.
Salibo and Turner are also both women of color. Salibo says in student government, it's a game changer.
Historically, women of color weren't in a lot of positions of power, mm-hmm. but now since the tables are changing and everything is changing, then it can definitely happen. And that's just what I want people to know, that it can happen for you, it happened for us, it can happen for you also.
Salibo says leading up to the election, her ticket received a lot of support from underrepresented students for its inclusivity.
We didn't know that was going to happen at the time. We just thought we wanted to make a huge impact on this campus. We wanted to make it a better place for not only us, but every other student.
The last 5 years of SGA administration saw three women on the board, one woman of color, and nine white men. As a team of three women and two women of color, Salibo says already this year, SGA more accurately represents the student body. Advancing gender equity is not just a value statement. It's good politics. Salibo and Turner say they go to events hosted by minority organizations to better understand the wants and needs of ISU's underrepresented population.
You can't represent everybody if you're not talking to everybody. That just brings a level of, that just brings their voice into the conversation.
Salibo's Vice President Jada Turner says every event brings about the same response. Students of color ask about the student government process.
They look at us and was like, wow, they really did that. That's super crazy. And it makes them want to get involved, and it makes them want to, I don't know, jump in and take the lead.
Turner says when students of color see minority representation on the executive board, it shows their thoughts and opinions matter. And with so few students of color appointed to the board in years past, Turner says it's about time those students have a fair voice. Turner says while it's an honor to represent those communities, she, Salibo, and Woody are gaining skills, too.
When we grow up and we get in our actual careers, this is something that we can look back on and be like, wow, I did this so early on. I can do this and take on other roles as well.
She says not only does the female administration inspire students, but they also inspire each other.
It'll continue. I don't think that this is going to be the only year that you'll see an all-female ticket. I definitely believe that there'll be in the future more to come.
The women say they plan to use their term to increase mental health awareness among students, faculty, and staff. I'm Mary Cullen.
Samiat Salibo, Jada Turner, and Hannah Woody also say they want to bring back the It's Just a Period campaign, which distributes feminine hygiene products to students. This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media, 89.1 and WGLT.org.
Hear the top NPR and local GLT news stories handpicked just for you right now on the NPR One app. Listen to GLT newscasts and our biggest stories on demand, or settle in for some podcast listening. You can even customize your favorite types of stories. NPR One has it all. Think Spotify or Pandora for news. This is GLT.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Still to come, a whole lot of pianos headed to Illinois Wesleyan University. You can see them on the street, being unpacked from crates today. Illinois Wesleyan University students will be getting a lesson in the nature of truth in a so-called era of alternative facts. Best-selling author and publisher of Skeptic magazine, Michael Shermer, is speaking during IWU's President's Convocation next week. That'll be September 4th. Shermer tells WGLT's Eric Stock, skepticism is a virtue we all should have, since much of what we believe turns out to be wrong.
You know, I want to encourage the faculty and students to be positive about the role of the academy in proffering tools for thinking critically about all kinds of claims, especially, you know, those coming from the commander in chief. I'm not going to be political at all in my talk. I'm not anti-Trump, pro-Trump, or anything like that in my talk. I'm just saying that it's encouraging that, for example, the rise of fact-checking sites like PolitiFact, for example, have, you know, found a niche since the 2016 election and have really become quite prominent. Other sites like Snopes or our own skeptic.com site, you know, people really do want to know what are the real facts. And they're not willing to accept alternative facts and fake news. So I think it's a positive message.
You are the founding publisher of Skeptic magazine. How do you define a skeptic?
Well, skepticism is just science. It's just the scientific way of analyzing claims. So we start with the null hypothesis that a claim is not true until proven otherwise. You have to have evidence. You have to have arguments. And if you don't, it's okay to just dismiss your claims. And so the burden of proof is on the person making the claim. So skepticism is really just the scientific way of thinking about any claim that anybody makes. And that could go from climate change to vaccines, to political claims about foreign relations or treaties or, you know, whatever.
Well, I get the sense from you that there is, in some corners of the world, there's not enough skepticism in our culture, and maybe there's too much cynicism in our culture at the same time.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate word for some reason. As long as I've been in the business, people seem to conflate skepticism and cynicism. They're not at all related. Again, skepticism is it's not a thing. It's just a tool like reason that we use to analyze claims and try to understand the world and what's true about it. Cynicism is definitely a strong position that's, you know, rather negatively valenced about worldviews or claims that are made. And we're not like that. We don't have a dog in the fight in terms of, like, we're always going to be skeptical or we're never going to be skeptical or anything like that. The moment you do that, then you're not really employing the rules of reason. So it very much matters that you have an open mind, but not so open that your brains fall out and you believe everything. There's some balance to be found there.
You referenced alternative facts, which I believe Kellyanne Conway had first coined while working for the White House. How much of this is attributed to this concept that there are, you know, two sides to every coin? Some believe vaccines are bad for you, that climate change is fake, and in some circles, we, even in the news media, are somehow expected to balance those two things.
Yes, it's sometimes it's disturbing when there aren't really two symmetrical sides, like on climate change or vaccines. You know, it's 99.99% of scientists agree on one particular conclusion. Of course, you can always find somebody that says, you know, climate change is a hoax or vaccines cause autism, despite the overwhelming facts. And so the news media should not feel the necessity to give both sides equal treatment when there aren't really two equal balanced sides. I mean, there's other issues where, you know, it's not super clear, like on diet and nutrition. You know, should you eat eggs or not? Should you go vegan or should you eat meat? You know, those are not settled issues, and there it's okay to have scientists on both sides. But climate change, you know, when 99% of climate scientists say it's real and human caused, you know, I think the media has an obligation to say, well, this is what the consensus is. And it's not a democracy. It's not like scientists vote about how they feel about climate.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stogg with Michael Shermer, a best-selling author and founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He is the featured speaker during Illinois Wesleyan's President's Convocation on September 4th. And on the flip side of cynicism is gullibility. Why are we so gullible? And you have explained that in some sense we are hardwired that way.
Yes, in a way, the default position is just believe whatever you hear. And then skepticism or doubting that thing that you just heard requires an extra cognitive step. That is to say, in order to doubt something, you have to know what the something is. And in the process of trying to understand that something, the brain tends to just believe it. And so it's an extra cognitive load to be skeptical. And that's why we have a free press. That's why we have science. And that's why we have the academy, hopefully, to teach students that, you know, just try to override that propensity to believe everything authorities say. Because often the authorities are in conflict with each other. And so you need to know how to think it through yourself.
But you've also explained, I've heard in past interviews, you've talked about why the brain sometimes seeks oversimplified solutions, you know, looking past the complexity and looking for easy answers. Why is that?
Well, complexity, again, is a higher cognitive load, which is tiresome and burdensome to grind through and think about. It's easier if there's just a single cause behind it. Like, you know, the economy is incredibly difficult to understand. I don't think anyone really understands it, even professional economists. So it's just easier to believe that, you know, there's 12 people in London called the Illuminati and they're running the show, or the New World Order, or Rockefellers, or the Rothschilds, or, you know, whatever your preferred New World Order conspiracy is. It simplifies things, and it means you don't have to think about it so much. It's in a way what labels do. You know, you're a Democrat, you're a Republican, you're a conservative, you're a liberal. Oh, good. Now I don't have to think about your positions anymore. I already know what you think. And that's unfortunate. I mean, we, you know, cognitively we need shortcuts because you can't process everything. So, you know, linguistic shortcuts in the form of labels help. but they can also, be misdirecting because they lead you to just draw certain conclusions about things that may or may not be true.
Now, I've heard that everyone has at least one conspiracy theory. Now, some may have more than others. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, that's true, and actually that's good, because in the case of conspiracy theories, some of them are true. There, historically speaking, there have been a lot of conspiracies. If we just find conspiracies or two or more people plotting in secret to gain an illegal or immoral advantage over somebody else or to harm somebody else, this happens all the time. I mean, the plot to assassinate Julius Caesar, that was a conspiracy. The assassination of Lincoln, that was a conspiracy. Watergate, Iran-Contra, these are all real conspiracies. We know corporations conspire, for example, tobacco industry, conspire to keep secret the connection between cigarette smoking and cancer.
I guess I should say unproven conspiracy theories.
Yes, okay, so there's the rub. Which conspiracy theories are true and which are false? So there we need to employ what I call my conspiracy detection kit, which I have a series of questions you could ask about any conspiratorial claim to see if it's true or not. And this has to do with how many people have to be involved, how competent they have to be, how many elements have to come together in just the right way, who else would know about it, what else would be true if that conspiracy was true. And so I just take the most recent one of, Jeffrey Epstein's suicide. Of course, everybody's going crazy about this. And even my own friends think I'm crazy to accept the suicide explanation. Well, okay, so let's say, the Clinton body count, it's part of the Clinton have lots of people murdered. Okay, how is that going to happen? Who orchestrated this? How did they get into the jail with cameras in the corridors? How did they get past the guards and so on? The moment you start kind of putting together all the things that would have to happen, you realize that it's very unlikely to be true. So everyone has their own preferred conspiracy in this sense, that the conspiracies we embrace tend to be those that are on our political side. So people that are in political power tend to be less conspiratorially minded than those out of power. So when Bush 43 was in office, the 9/11 truthers were mostly on the liberal side. Then once Obama took office, the truthers kind of disappeared and the birthers arose. Those who think, that Obama faked his birth certificate and so on, those tended to be Republicans. So often conspiracy theories are linked to politics and religion or race or, belief systems.
And as we continue on Sound Ideas, I'm Eric Stogg with Michael Shermer, a best-selling author and founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine. He is the featured speaker during Illinois Wesleyan's President's Convocation on September 4th. Michael, as you prepare to speak to college students, this seems appropriate to ask. You wrote last year about a study which indicates students in this internet generation, or iGen, those born after 1995 to the mid-2000s, have a greater likelihood of psychological disorders, including depression, and the rates have increased dramatically over the last decade. And it says use of digital media plays a major factor in determining mental well-being. Now, we know the terms fear of missing out, fear of being left out, but you believe it's deeper than that. How does our culture magnify the divisions that social media often creates or at least worsens?
Yeah, those things are true, although since I've written that, there's been two studies that have challenged the social media hypothesis for the increase in depression. Now, the numbers are real. That is to say, kids born after 1995, iGeners, do have significantly higher rates of depression, suicidal ideation, anxiety disorders, and about three times more women than men. Those facts are true. The question is why. And so there's a couple hypotheses. The social media hypothesis was strong for a while, and women use more social media than men, so the fear of being left out and so on. But there's two studies now claiming that's not the case. So a second hypothesis is the coddling of iGeners, that is, we baby boomer and millennial parents during the late 80s and early 90s crime wave before the crime decline of the mid to late 90s became helicopter soccer parents afraid of anything and everything that could happen. That plus the safetyism culture, where lawyers basically directed playgrounds to make them perfectly safe places, and everything down to dodgeball was too dangerous. And that kind of safetyism culture and a hyper parenting culture, helicopter parenting, that's the new hypothesis. That remains to be seen if that'll hold up. This is a good example of how science works. It's what we call conjecture and refutation. You put a hypothesis out there and you test it and you see if it holds. If it doesn't, you try something else. And so this is still new. It's hard to say what the cause of this increase is, and hopefully we can turn it around.
That was author Michael Shermer with WGLT's Eric Stock. Shermer has appeared on a number of TV programs, including 2020, Dateline, Oprah, Unsolved Mysteries, and The Colbert Report, just to name a few. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. If you want to see what close to 36 pianos look like coming out of the box, drop by Illinois Wesleyan University today. The music department is taking delivery of 32 new Steinway pianos, part of a $3.5 million grant from the C.B. Frevert Family Trust. Ilya Radoslavov is the head of the keyboard department at IWU. Dave Horeen is the university piano technician and a piano store owner in Bloomington Normal. Horeen says he's been working toward this goal of making Illinois Wesleyan an all-Steinway school for more than three decades.
It's going to have a lot to do with the retention and attraction of prospective students.
Oh, yes, this is definitely, it's kind of a dream come true. And Steinway has always been, synonymous with quality. So I think this will be a wonderful way to re-energize our recruiting efforts and to actually tell the Illinois community and the Bloomington Normal community that wonderful things are happening on our campus. And we're very excited about this. And clearly, we couldn't have done this without the generous donation of the, from the Frevert.
C.B. Frevert, who farmed out near Stanford and last year had a land auction to generate money for his family foundation, a charitable foundation, after his death. How many pianos are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about 37 pianos that we'll be purchasing, and we're trading in 45. We're going to get it to the ideal number of pianos that we need, and that's in the 75 range. Right now, we have 99 pianos just in the School of Music. Most of them are over 50 years old, and quite a few of them are over 100 years old. So it was time that we really needed to replace a lot of dead or dying instruments.
Are you going for all new right now, or will you stage a timed replacement later on for the next cycle and the next generation?
Very good question. It will be... every other year, we plan to be able to purchase one more new piano and trade one in. Fortunately, we're being very frugal with what we are replacing in order to become the Steinway School. And then that gives us money then to replace them and keep turning our inventory so we gradually will have a new inventory. So about half of the pianos will be replaced.
More than a decade ago, Illinois Wesleyan University had a piano sale, which the company brought in a number of used pianos from other music schools, including the ones in Illinois Wesleyan University's practice rooms, and sold them to private buyers. In return, Yamaha sold IWU pianos at a lower cost and shared a portion of the proceeds. How many different ways are there to finance a huge ticket item in any music school's accounting?
Well, there are lease programs available. But the banks will only do a lease on Steinway pianos, primarily because Steinway pianos last for a good decade, and their good useful life is a good 75, 80 years in a college setting. It's a lot different than in a home setting because they get used quite a bit more. And that actually was not a Yamaha program. That was a Kauai program.
Kauai, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and they actually... trucked in pianos from their factory to do this sale, and Wesleyan actually didn't buy but one or two of those pianos.
Okay. Why is having a single maker a good thing, whether it's Kawai or Yamaha or Steinway, for students?
Well, that's a good question. I will let David answer the, since he's the piano technician and the person who is taking care of these pianos, I will.
Okay. Well, 99% of all concert stages only have Steinway pianos on them. They could have Yamahas, they have Kawais, they could have Baldwins, they could have anything from China that they wanted to. But every musician that's serious about playing only wants to play on a Steinway & Sons piano.
Some people do like Bösendorfers.
There are two artists that do. The big difference between piano manufacturers is that, like with Yamaha and Kawai and Bösendorfer, they provide free pianos for artists to use. Steinway doesn't do that. You have to purchase their piano. Otherwise, it's an implied endorsement that you're endorsing that piano. So any Steinway artist that you see playing anywhere in any venue, either the venue owns the piano or the artist himself owns it.
So what, Ilya, what makes a Steinway a Steinway in terms of quality, in terms of feel, in terms of responsiveness in the instrument?
Well, yes, thank you. That's my personal preference, of course. And my, you know, I always prefer, if I have a choice, I always prefer to use a Steinway. The warmth of the sound quality, the depth of the sound, the control, the feel of the instrument, it's quite different. It makes, it puts me at ease, puts me as a performer at ease. And of course, we have to instill those abilities and into what students will be looking for, and ultimately for me is the warmth of the sound quality in addition to everything else, of course, that I listen, but that's my first that's what I go for
from a technical standpoint. Then Dave, what allows Steinway to make that warmth? Is it the internal design? Is it the components? Is it some mystical elixir that they pour over the frame?
Well, it's all magic.
Okay. I don't know.
No, actually, Steinway pianos are totally handcrafted. It takes a full year just to make one Steinway piano. You're dealing with over 12,000 parts. There are more parts in a piano than there are in an automobile. Steinway has two gentlemen that travel all over the world just to select the woods for their pianos. And then those go into the mill that Steinway has at their factory in Queens. And still 60% of it's rejected once it gets to the factory. So it's the finest of the finest of the finest materials. No other manufacturer does that or could afford to do it. And it's not saying that there aren't other good pianos out there, but the most durable, the most reliable, the most rewarding to a pianist is only the Steinway piano.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. We're talking with Dave Horine, owner of Horine's Pianos Plus. He's also the School of Music piano technician at Illinois Wesleyan University. And Ilya Radoslavov, an associate professor of music and keyboard and the keyboard department head at Illinois Wesleyan. Illinois Wesleyan has become a Steinway school thanks to a $3.5 million gift. So piano quality over time changes even in a single maker. Company fortunes, technology, even fashions change, an almost meaningless change. We can't call it tickling the ivories anymore because ivory isn't allowed for keys. I even saw a story years ago that lamented the fall of Steinway after World War II because the sheepskin used to cushion a part of the action inside the piano was different because the proprietary flock of sheep that Steinway had kept in Britain was a casualty of the need for protein in World War II. So could you talk about that? How has piano making changed? How has the sound of pianos changed over the decades?
The neat thing about piano manufacturing is that there are always innovations. Every 10 years or so, Steinway has a new patent on this, a new patent on that. So not only have the refinements improved and the design, although it's still originally the winning design that they had in 1900 when they designed these pianos. But our glues have gotten so much better. They still have and own quite a few forests where they grow their own hard rock maple and their spruce and their poplar. All the woods that are used in the pianos are primarily grown by Steinway. And so all of our latest improvements, our refinements, these are the finest pianos. And I've been associated with Steinway. I trained in the factory starting in the late 60s. I was only 3 years old. Yeah, you've heard that one before. I have seen these, and you're correct. There are some years that were really pretty bad for all piano manufacturers. It had a lot to do with competition and trying to have the lowest price piano and this sort of thing. Steinway has never subscribed to that thought of being the lowest price piano. Their philosophy is we will build the best piano possible, and then we will assign it a price.
Dave Harine is an instrument store owner and Illinois Wesleyan University's piano technician. Ilya Radoslavov is the head of the keyboard department at IWU. The pianos being delivered to Illinois Wesleyan today make up the first part of a three-phased replacement of more than 40 pianos as IWU becomes an all-Steinway school. IWU is today also ditching 24 pianos, some of which are close to a century old. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, Eric Stock, and Ryan Denham. Thanks to Mayor Terry Renner for coming in to talk as well. I'm Charlie Schlenker. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's Public Media.